This fella gets about 30 paces before she rips out his guts. Them two try to fight her together. It's the same every time. I know it, but I can't stop watching.
The same every time? Liv looked back to the first man and position of the sword below him. It was the same as before. Exactly the same. The blood that had pooled beneath his severed head had slowly receded to nothing. This wasn't a murder. It was a mummer's show, which actually didn't make it any less impressive.
What are you doing?
Someone called out behind Liv. She hadn't even realized she was walking forward, but she didn't stop. As she got closer, it became more and more apparent that she'd been right. She walked closer as, sure enough, the second man tore free and ran away. But then the spider stopped in its pursuit, froze, and turned. The crowd behind Liv gasped. The spider bounded back with great speed, going straight for Liv. Liv froze, her heart leaping into her throat. The spider stopped, right in front of her. Great pincer jaws snapping together, four legs lifted to grab her. Too frightened to move, Liv watched those jaws clack, clack together, not 10 paces away. Clack, clack. Soundlessly? Liv let out a breath she hadn't realized she was holding. She tightened her eyes and saw that the ground around her was laced with superviolet triggers. Brilliant. She stepped to her left. And the spider didn't move until she stepped into the next zone, and then it was there, fast. And now that she was this close, she could see that the cavern behind the spider looked all wrong. It wasn't nearly as deep as it appeared from 50 paces out. It was like a painting, with light and shadow used to make it appear that there was an entire cave where there was none. And the spider itself was crafted entirely of primary, stable Luxin colours, layered so that it wouldn't be obvious that it was a Luxin creation. As Liv moved past the triggers, the spider went bounding after the man who had escaped, but somehow hadn't taken advantage of the last 30 seconds to actually run away. The spider ripped out his guts, just as the man had said. Liv touched the Luxin of the wall and immediately forgot about the genius of the spider mummery. The yellow Luxin was flawless. It was perfection. Forgetting where she was, she drafted directly from the yellow glow of the wall. Drafting from yellow Luxin had once been pursued as the perfect source of light, at least for yellows, but it had never panned out. Something was always lost, it was always inefficient. But with an entire wall, leagues long, inefficiency didn't matter. Liv drew a little torch of solid Luxin into her hand to better see the wall when illuminated by a second source of light. Sometimes drafters hid things in their construction that—
Hey, mistress, what are you doing out here? All drafters are supposed to be inside the walls already.
Startled, Liv saw a grizzled old soldier coming toward her, wearing the uniform of a Tyrian sergeant, a brace of nice wheel-lock pistols at his belt, and an empty scabbard. His face was smudged with gunpowder, or smoke, and there were light bandages wrapped around his hands. He glanced at Liv's forearms as he approached. She tried desperately to remember the lie she'd prepared, in case someone asked her about her lack of the coloured vambraces.
You're dazzled by bright water wall. I know, all the drafters is. Where are your arms?
Arms? Liv guessed he meant the colour vambraces all the other drafters wore.
I was invited to the Colour Lord's party last night, and I had a bit much to drink, I'm afraid. I fell asleep behind a bush, and my unit either didn't find me or thought it would be funny to leave me there,
Naked!
Liv blushed as much from the brazenness of her lie as anything.
I'm lucky I still have my specs, she said, showing him her yellow spectacles tucked in a pocket.
I'd probably drink a lot if I were asked to that party myself. Put on your specs and go to the gate, they'll let you through. Then go to Quartermaster Zid. He's a real bastard and he'll give you all sorts of trouble, but— Oh, hell. Come with me, I'll take you. That's me, Master Sergeant Galandalelo, sucker for a pouty lip and a clueless gaze.
Hey, Liv said.
Joking, joking,
Galan said.
You actually remind me of my daughter, and if she's clueless, she got it all from her father. Come on.
He turned.
And you, all you damned fools, it ain't real. It's just a show. Stop piddling yourselves.
He slapped the wall to emphasize his point, and half the crowd ducked at the sharp sound. Mumbling to himself, he took her to the gate. Even the soldiers continued to march through. They'd left a narrow two lanes on one side for messengers and nobles and drafters to pass, and the guards there knew the master sergeant and let him right through. Inside the wall he weaved quickly between tents, walking fast, and cut to the front of a line of lower-ranking soldiers to speak with the quartermaster.
"Need yellow rags for this girl here,"
Galen announced to the quartermaster's back as the big, hunchbacked man was collecting half a dozen swords to give to some young soldier. Quartermaster Zid turned.
"I don't recognize her. She's not with the units I supply. Forget it."
"You're going to give me hell tonight, you crazy old ninny. Do I need to put my foot up your ass?"
"Ninny? You come harping on me like a harridan, and you expect roses and wine? I ought to pound that ugly nose of yours flat,"
the hunchbacked man said. Galan laughed, rubbing a nose that had obviously been broken many times.
"I seem to recall you trying that a time or two."
The quartermaster grinned, and Liv's terror faded as she realized the two were good friends.
"I know you're happy to see I'm alive," Galan said, "so just do me a favor and give the girl the rags."
"Yellow?"
Zid asked. He poured the swords onto the counter, ignoring the young soldier who tried and failed to grab all of them and almost skewered himself trying unsuccessfully to keep them on the counter.
"Yes," Liv said.
He grabbed a list.
"Name?"
"Liv."
He scanned quickly.
"No Livs, sorry. There's not a yellow drafter named Liv in the entire army."
Liv's mouth went dry.
"You and you,"
Zid said, pointing to some soldiers waiting irritated in line.
"Arrest this woman. We'll need to report an imposter." "Oh, for all Holam's sake, Zid, what do you think she is, a spy? She's probably barely 16. What kind of a swiving fool would send a baby to spy on us?"
At the word spy, Liv's knees turned to water.
"Maybe a very cunning fool who thought we would discount her for that very reason," Zid said,
suspicion leaking out of his very pores.
"They say Gavin Guile did. They say some boy over in the Chirurgeon's tents is his own bastard. Who'd send a child? Those wily bastards, that's who."
He nodded vaguely toward Gaddiston.
"I'm 17, she said instead.
What? Kip was in the Chirurgeon's tents? Was he sick? Wounded? She was too flustered and scared to rejoice that she'd just heard her first lead to Kip's whereabouts.
"Come on, Zid. Those lists are barely good enough to wipe your arse on once the fighting starts, you know that. It's like you've never done this bef-"
"Gotcha,"
Zid said. He threw back his head and laughed. He threw some yellow sleeves across the table.
"That was for the ninny crack. Now we're even."
"Even? Oh, we're not even close to even,"
Galan said, but he was smiling.
"Nah, duty calls. Nice to meet you, Liv, and if you ever can, knock this fella down a notch or three, would you?"
"Gladly,"
Liv said, smiling over the sick feeling in her stomach as if she were glad to be in on the joke. In minutes, she was alone, and, donning her sleeves for the first time, she was in. Now all she had to do was save Kip and Karius. And really, how hard could that be? Not for the first time in the last few days, Liv wanted to swear and throw things and whine and complain and, maybe just a little, she wanted to cry. Instead, she took a deep breath and headed deeper into camp. Chapter 75. When Gavin opened his eyes, it was bright out. There was a figure sitting beside his bed. He looked at her. His mother.
"Oh, thank God, Holam. I thought I was awake," Gavin said.
Felia Guile laughed, and he knew he wasn't dreaming. His mother's laughter sounded somehow freer than it had in years.
"It's almost noon, son. I know I hardly have to lecture you on duty, but you really should get up."
"Noon?" Gavin sat bolt upright. It was a mistake. His whole body hurt. His head hurt. His eyes hurt. He held himself still while the hammer blows to the back of his head receded from 10-weight sledges to 5-weight sledges, and his eyes found focus once more. He usually didn't get light sick, but then he'd never used so much magic as he had yesterday either. Not since Sundered Rock, and he'd been young then. "It's almost noon on Sunday?" he asked.
"We thought it best to spare you greeting the sun and the dawn processional. It was going to be a more informal Sunday this year, regardless. Or Holam will forgive us."
"Mother, what are you doing here?"
"It's time, Gavin."
time?
For my freeing.
Gavin felt a wave of cold dread course down his body from head to toe. No, not his mother. She'd said some time in the next 5 years. She'd given him time to prepare, but it couldn't be this early. Father, he asked instead. She folded her hands in her lap, her voice holding quiet dignity.
Your father has made far too many decisions for me. The freeing is between a drafter and Orholm.
So he doesn't know, Gavin said.
I'm sure he knows by now, she said, a little sparkle in her eyes.
You ran away? And that would have been what it was, too. She would have slipped out at night, bribed a ship captain some obscene amount, and gone before Andros Giles' spies could even report back. She would have chosen the fastest ship in port, so that even if Andros sent a ship with the next tide, his men would still arrive too late. It was, Gavin had to admit, brilliant. And it would not go over well with Andros Giles. Not at all. She was quiet for a long moment.
Son, I've told your father I wished to join the freeing every year for the last 5 years. He forbade it. I can feel myself slipping away. I haven't drafted for 3 years, and my life feels grey. I love your father dearly, but he's always been a very selfish man. Andros wants to hold on to his life and his power forever, and he doesn't want to be alone. I pity him, son. And I've given him these years for the love we once shared. You know I'm loyal, but we both know he'll see this as a betrayal. And I know that he'll blame you rather than himself, but if I have to choose between my duty to your father and my duty to Orholm,
Orholm wins. She patted his knee.
I've sent a courier to Corvin Danavis.
Corvin's alive? At the wall, I was afraid— She smiled sadly.
He's well. But your defenders lost the wall, despite your heroics.
My heroics. Only his mother could talk about his heroics without a hint of irony in her voice. What would you think about that down in your prison, brother?
Anyway, I've sent a courier to let him know you're awake. I'm glad to see him again. He's a good man.
She knew, of course, that Corvin had taken a life in exile in order for Gavin's masquerade to work, but as always, she was circumspect, just in case there were spies eavesdropping. Gavin's mother had always had a gift for figuring out how to live her life and let her opinions be known despite the pressures of court life and the demands of protocol, secrecy and discretion.
I'll see you tonight, son.
Gavin got dressed slowly after she left, testing his body to see if he'd done any permanent damage with yesterday's exertions. He was sore, but he surely deserved worse. His muscles would loosen up as the day progressed, and he thought he'd be ready to draft the necessities this evening, past noon, on a Sunday. There was a quick little flurry of light knocks on the door, the tempo of an old song he and Corvin used to enjoy. The door opened. Corvin came in.
You're up!
He sounded surprised. Not much the worse for wear. Thanks for letting me sleep in, but you know you need my help today. What's the situation? Gavin was lacing up his shirt. Corvin grabbed Gavin's face in both of his hands and stared in his eyes. Gavin slapped his hands to knock them away, but Corvin held him firmly.
What the hell are you doing?
Gavin demanded.
You should be dead, Corvin said. Do you remember how much you drafted yesterday?
I remember it vividly, thank you, including quite a headache that you're not making any better. After staring for a few more moments, Corvin released him.
I'm sorry, Lord Prism. They say there are signs when a prism starts dying. I have no idea what they are, but I figured if anything would break you, it would be what you did yesterday. Even a prism shouldn't be able to draft that much. But your eyes look fine.
Gavin shrugged it off. How did we lose the war? Corvin blew out a breath.
Brass Caradul is either brilliant or crazy. Or just crazy, that's how.
So no one shot that moron as he charged the gate?
They got lucky. I think you scared both sides half to death with what you did. The snipers were shaking so hard they couldn't hit an easy target. Then, when the men saw that Rask was charging and you had fallen, they thought you were dead, that he'd somehow defeated you. The blackguards pulled out to take you to safety, and most of the best Tyrians we had already been killed in the fighting.
He pinched his nose between his eyes. Tension headaches. Gavin had forgotten how Corvin always got those when there was fighting to be done. Gavin could imagine it now, the prism down, the elite blackguards suddenly pulling out, and the enemy charging as if unfazed by all Gavin had done. No wonder the Tyrians had lost courage. So King Haradul's men joined his charge and what? Our men melted? Got massacred? What?
They actually held the gate for a few minutes. They bungled the troop refresher manoeuvres I tried to teach them, though.
That was when fresh musketeers with loaded weapons would switch with the frontline troops.
But there were passing loaded muskets up the ranks, handing back fired muskets to be reloaded. They were losing ground, but not fast, and the wall defences were holding. It was getting dark. I thought we were going to hold it.
And then?
They ran out of powder.
He sighed. Gavin could tell that the general took it as a personal failure.
There was plenty elsewhere, of course. I'd sent men to take care of it, but war happens.
Confusion, or spies, or the couriers being killed, or the wagon men who were supposed to bring the black powder forward deserting, on top of officers not checking back in and double-checking that the orders had been followed, either through their own inexperience or cowardice or death. Any link in the entire chain could break, with an army in which few men had trained at all, and few units had trained together. It was simply that the supply of black powder was the link that had broken. Of course, that wouldn't have mattered if Gavin had built the damned gate first, or if he'd been stronger, or if that cannonball hadn't crashed through his forms. But second-guessing was futile.
"Our defenders broke and ran," Corvin said. "King Haradul didn't send anyone after us. I managed a fairly orderly retreat for the men in the wall. I suppose Haradul thinks we'll surrender. Maybe he thought mercy would accomplish his objectives more quickly than wiping out as many men as he could. Or he didn't want his men killing each other in the darkness. Or he's devout and this new religion of his forbids night fighting."
"Old religion, I think," Gavin said.
"They're not giving any sign of attacking today."
"Sunday is holy even to pagans," Gavin said.
"So we have until tomorrow. What do you want to do, Lord Prism?"
"When you thought I was incapacitated, what did you decide to do?"
"Whatever goodwill King Haradul gained in the city by sparing the men who fled yesterday, he more than lost by using Cullerwhites in battle. The city is wild with tales of monsters. They're terrified. 2 days ago I was worried they would turn against us in a heartbeat. They watched you build a wall to protect them, and they saw what you were protecting them from. So now they trust you, and they revile the man who slaughtered their friends with the help of abominations. This whole city is yours. If you show your face, they'll follow you to the gates of the Evernight."
"Corvin, the question." Corvin rubbed his neck, hesitated.
"We can't win. The old stone wall around the city couldn't keep out a determined mule. Rask took most of our gunpowder when he took the wall, and all of our cannons. Half our muskets were left on the field as men dropped them when they fled. We'll be lucky to kill a few thousand before they took the inner wall, and once we start fighting street to street, we could kill quite a few at some choke points, but eventually their numbers guarantee it will be a slaughter. With their numbers and our lack of material, this city is indefensible. There's no strategy I can imagine in which we win. We can hurt them badly while we lose, but that's not the same."
He grimaced.
"I was preparing a retreat."
A retreat. Corvin Danvis had never lost a battle. Well, if one didn't count Sundered Rock as a loss, which Gavin didn't. If you mean to lose, and you do, in exactly the way you intended, it's not really a loss, is it?
"Even a retreat is beset with unforeseen difficulties, Lord Prism. The presence of the monsters that put everyone in the city on our side also means everyone in the city wants out. They think they'll be slaughtered and eaten if they stay, and there's no way we can evacuate so many people with the ships and the time we have."
Gavin rubbed his forehead, threw on his ceremonial white cloak. Stalled, basically. "Have our spies reported anything about Karis?" he asked, trying to sound disinterested. Not that Corvin would be fooled.
"Still alive as of yesterday. I imagine he was planning to use her to barter with if he needed to."
Which now, of course, he wouldn't. Meaning Karis had become expendable. Corvin didn't have to say it aloud. "Kip, or Liv, or Iron Fist?" If Gavin had been thinking, or a little less self-centered, he'd have asked about Corvin's daughter first.
"No word,"
Corvin said. His jaw was tight. Which could be good news, right? If they'd done anything disastrous, our spies would be more likely to hear about it, right? Corvin didn't say anything for a while, refusing to take such weak solace. He wasn't a man to grasp after straws or to believe that tragedy couldn't befall him. The deaths of two wives had cured him of idealism.
Our spies did report that there's some kind of king of the color whites, a polychrome white. They're calling him Lord Omnichrome. No word on who he was before breaking the pact. Unless he's a true wild polychrome.
Gavin shrugged. Just another problem among hundreds. But he knew Corvin was laying all the potential problems on the table so Gavin could make his own choices about what was and was not important.
What do you want to do, Lord Prism?
He meant about the battle, or the evacuation, of course. I want to kill Rask Haradul. Corvin said nothing. Didn't move to order an assassination or something similarly stupid. Damn him. But Gavin's father had predicted even this. If you lose the city, kill Rask Haradul, Andros Gyle had said. Gavin had been sure he could save the city, and hadn't arranged assassins to kill Rask. He should have done both. Too late now, unless Rask charged him tomorrow as foolishly as he had done yesterday. Gavin moved to speak, but the words wouldn't come. He cleared his throat, trying to remove the taste of failure. I'll help as much as I can while performing my religious duties, but... He cleared his throat again. 7 years. 7 great purposes. Yet I was trying to do something good for once. I failed, Corvin. Order the evacuation. Chapter 76. Judging from the cold air licking his skin, it was well after midnight when Kip was escorted through some kind of gate. He had to judge from the temperature because he was wearing a blindfold, along with a black sack over his head, a noose around his neck, hands bound behind his back. One of the guards who was accompanying him was cursing, quietly but constantly, awed by something apparently called Bright Water Wall. They passed through slowly, stopping and starting, some military-sounding voice barking,
"Don't stand there and pick your butts! Move deeper into camp, you're blocking everyone else!"
Kip heard the crack of a whip like a pistol shot, and the line started moving again. The last couple of days had been like this. Kip had woken in darkness, darkness that turned out to be a blindfold, his hands bound at his sides. When he struggled to get it off, men had come. They removed the blindfold, one stared at his eyes, pulling them wide open with rough fingers, then they blindfolded him again. His left hand was agony. That first day, if it was just a day, they had dosed his wine with something foul that dulled his pain and his senses. They'd taken him to see Lord Omnichrome, withholding Kip's dosed wine so he would be lucid, but they never removed the blindfold. They'd sat in a tent with many voices for hours, with Kip in agony, and then they'd left. Apparently the Lord was too busy to see him. After a while, Kip heard his guards arguing. A clever man would have figured out some way to exploit their divisions. Kip just stood quietly, wondering when his next dose would be. His hand was throbbing. They handed him off to someone else, literally handing over the noose around his neck.
"Aren't you going to give him the poppy wine?" one of his guards asked.
"Why waste good poppy on bad blubber?" the other guard asked. "I like poppy wine my own self."
"Oh, that stuff tastes foul," the first said.
Kip could agree with that.
"I don't drink it for the taste," the guard said, laughing.
Kip could agree with that, too.
"Let's go. I saw some women a ways back, with your charm and my poppy wine."
He laughed again. Kip was pulled into a wagon. He stumbled up the steps and nearly strangled on the noose, but soon found his seat. The door was closed behind him. Someone loosened his noose, pulled it off, took off his hood, pulled off his blindfold. "Kip?" she asked. Kip blinked. Though the light in the violet room was dim, after 2 days in total darkness, it made his eyes water nonetheless, but through the blear of his tears, he made out Caris Whiteoak.
"Caris?"
he asked. "Stupid question. Of course it's her. You're looking at her, you idiot."
"Kip, what are you doing here?"
"I'm here to rescue you," he said.
Then he laughed.
"Kip, how much poppy wine did they give you?"
It had been hours since they'd given him wine, but he just laughed harder. Caris guided Kip to her pallet in the wagon. He fell asleep instantly. She stared at him. A hard, mean part of her wanted to hate him. My son would be Kip's age. How? Kip could be my son. He does have blue eyes. And my grandmother was Parian. What, you think brown skin and kinky hair skips a generation? Like twins? Caris rubbed her face. It was an idle fantasy, and she knew it. The son she'd abandoned was Kip's half-brother. But any similarities they shared would be because they shared Gavin as a father, and what a father he'd been. To both boys. She had to get out of here. She was thinking too much. Caris watched Kip sleep, seeing the guile blood in the shape of his brow and his nose, and she couldn't even name the feelings in her heart. Eventually she covered him with her blanket. Chapter 77 Gavin survived the noon rituals. The Laxiat, a perfectly well-intentioned young green, was shaken like a leaf through the whole thing. Garriston wasn't exactly a prime posting, so no doubt the young man hadn't expected to ever catch a glimpse of the prism, much less meet him. Much less be responsible for performing the Sunday ritual with him. They muddled through, Gavin prompting the young man with his lines two or three times. It took an hour and a half, and that was with Gavin cutting short the list, beseeching Orholm's blessing on every noble in the seven satrapies and every official in the Chromeria. If even Orholm can't remember their names, maybe they aren't all that important, eh? He told the Luxiat, leaving the young man gawping. It was early afternoon before he could escape. Escape being relative, of course. He had a dozen blackguards, a secretary, four messengers, and a dozen city guards accompanying him. He went to the docks. He found Corvin there, ably directing the mess. The crowd wasn't as bad as he had assumed it would be. Perhaps people were holding out hope that Gavin would save them. Perhaps after seeing him build an impossible wall, they thought his powers were unlimited. Perhaps some were simply religiously observant. Only absolutely necessary work was supposed to be done on this holiest of days. Good thing staying alive doesn't count as absolutely necessary. Many nobles were bartering with ship captains. Boxes of goods were piled on the docks, and plenty of goods that weren't in boxes. Rolled up tapestries that must have hung in families' great halls. Furniture with gold leaf paint, artwork, a maze of trunks packed with Orholm knew what.
Lord Prism, General Danavis said, coming up to Gavin quickly. Perfect timing.
Which means you're about to hand over some truly unpleasant duty.
I gave the order yesterday that no ships were to leave the harbour in case an evacuation became necessary. I let it be known that disobedience meant seizure of the ship for the captain and death for whoever hired him.
It was a harsh sentence. But war called for harsh sentences. Whoever took a ship out of the city early was condemning dozens to death if Garriston were overrun and a massacre began. The problem with harsh sentences was that someone always tried to call your bluff. Once.
Who was it? Gavin asked. He thought he knew already.
Governor Crassos. His men fired on the blackguards who went to stop them.
Blackguards? How'd Corvin get blackguards to obey a fetch-me-that-prisoner order?
Any hurt?
No, Lord Prism.
He's here? Gavin asked.
He needed to get out of here. His entourage was blocking Corvin's people from coming and going through the street as they needed to, and they were blocking access to the docks as well. But this he wouldn't dodge. It was better to handle these things in a way that reinforced the solemnity of the law, but it was best to handle them quickly before others disobeyed the same law and you ended up having to kill more. When the sands were running out of the glass, delayed justice was as bad as injustice.
Bring the sailors, too, and whatever cargo he was taking, Gavin told Corvin quietly. Governor Crassos was, indeed, barely 10 paces away. He'd just been surrounded by guards much taller than he was, blocking him from sight. His hands were bound behind his back and one eye was swelling. A motley collection of smugglers were brought forward with him, scruffy, hard-edged men who'd taken on the job knowing the risks. Gavin raised both hands over his head, throwing out a small fan of sparks. Anyone who hadn't been looking before was now.
I hereby convene this adjudication in the light of Orholm's eye. Let justice be done.
Heads bobbed all around the docks in acknowledgement of the sudden prayer. The accused were pushed roughly to their knees. Humility before justice. If I'm going to block the docks, I might as well accomplish something while I'm here.
Governor, you're accused of hiring a ship to flee the city against the orders of the general in charge. Is this true?
General? I'm the governor of this shithole,
No one tells me what to do.
Not even I? Gavin asked. The general was acting in my name, given explicit authority to do so. Did you hire this crew to leave the city?
You've got 50 witnesses who'll tell you I did. So what? We helped you. My family stood by you in the war. You wouldn't be here without us.
Governor Crassus's voice trailed to a whine.
You're going to put these peasants in front of me?
Captain, Gavin said, turning away from the governor, you acknowledge your attempt to flee? The captain looked around, defiant, unbroken, but not quite daring to meet the prison's eye. Apparently everyone on the docks had seen the attempt. He had the air of a man who knew he was going to die and wanted to die well. He was holding his courage in a tight grip.
Yes, sir. The governor hired us last night. I already wanted out.
Of course he did. Every man with a ship wanted out, and wanted out yesterday. It is an old tradition, Gavin said loudly for the assembled crowd, to grant one pardon on Sunday. As Orholm is merciful, so should we be merciful.
Oh, thank Orholm and his prism among us, Governor Crassus said, struggling to his feet. You won't regret this, Lord Prism?
Gavin drafted Super Violet for its invisibility and smacked it across the back of Crassus's knees, never even looking at him. The man dropped. Gavin addressed the captain. Captain, by rights I should lock you in a cell and leave you there to whatever fate might find you. Instead, I'm going to release you, and I'm going to give you my ship, the ship you forfeited, and your crew. I'll be watching you, Captain. Serve well. The captain looked poleaxed. Then, embarrassingly, his eyes welled with sudden tears.
What?
Crassus demanded. Governor Crassus, you have disobeyed my order and demeaned your office. A governor is to bear up his people, not weigh them down. You have stolen from the people Orholm gave you the duty to lead. You are a thief and a coward. I hereby strip you of your governorship. You wanted to take your riches and leave? So be it. Gavin selected a trunk from among those Crassus had taken with him. It was full of rich clothing, large and so heavy that one man would have trouble holding it. He shot large holes in the top, bottom, and sides. He gave orders, and guards put the trunk in Crassus's arms, and then bound it to him with ropes.
You can't do this, Crassus said.
It's done, Gavin said. Your only choice now is how you face it.
My family will hear of this, Crassus said.
Then let them hear you died like a man, Gavin said. It was like Gavin had slapped the man across the face. His family obviously meant everything to him. Gavin drafted a blue platform out into the water. You wanted to flee, Lord Crassus? Go. Without hesitation, Lord Crassus walked down the steps of Blue Luxin and out onto the water, carrying his trunk. He got out about 15 paces before the Luxin cracked and he fell into the water. In moments he was kicking to keep the buoyant chest from bobbing over his head and drowning him. The tide was just turning, so he merely sloshed back and forth, neither pushed in closer to shore nor washed out toward the other piers or toward the Guardian and the open sea. A 1,000 pairs of eyes watched him silently. In a minute he wasn't having to kick so hard to keep the trunk from pushing him under, because the trunk wasn't floating as high in the water. He was trying to stare defiantly toward the dock, toward Gavin, but his wet hair was falling in front of his eyes, and he couldn't seem to shake his head enough to get it out of them. He screamed something right before he went under. Gavin couldn't understand him. More death. He hadn't liked Crassus, hated his attitude, hated the type of noble he represented, who took, and never thought to give a crumb back. But he'd just killed a man. Made enemies of his family, and this in the midst of a war that would have done the job for him. Gavin watched for the bubbles and didn't see any. Crassus had floated too far out. Gavin raised his hands and then brought them in. Orholm have mercy, he announced, bringing the adjudication to a close. He'd already spent too much time here. He turned. Behind him in the bay, a shark's fin cut the water like an arrow, headed for its target. Chapter 78. At sunset, Gavin had finished the most public of the rituals of the day. It was a big show, and he did his best to make each one special. It was one part of the day he could feel good about. He always performed nearly naked. Colours bloomed and raced through his body, out of his body, and gave the appearance of going back into him. It hurt a little to use so much magic after yesterday's fight, but it was one thing he wouldn't compromise. All too soon, however, it was over, and people were retiring to their parties. The parties would go all night. Sunday lasted until the next dawn. The parties of those to be freed would begin at full dark. He was sitting in a little chapel in the fortress. He had a few minutes, supposedly to pray. There was a time when he had used it to pray. No more. If Orholm was real, he was busy. He was asleep. He didn't care. He was taking a shit. Time was different to Orholm, they said. That would explain why he'd been doing it for Gavin's entire life. Gavin's chest felt tight. He was having trouble breathing. The chapel seemed too small, too dark. He was sweating, cold, clammy sweat. He closed his eyes. Get some balls, Gavin. You can do this. You've done it before. This is for them. It's a lie. It's all a lie. It's better than the alternative. Breathe. This isn't for you. You want to go out there and tell those drafters waiting for you that their entire lives are a fraud? That their service is a waste? That Orholm doesn't see their sacrifice? That what they've done, what they've given, doesn't matter? Everyone dies, Gavin. Don't rob it of meaning for these people. Don't make them see themselves as worthless, their sacrifice as empty, all life as meaningless. It was the same debate he had with himself every year. He'd even brought a bucket with him into the chapel, along with extra incense. He threw up some years. There was a knock at the door of the chapel. Lord Prism, it's time. Kip wasn't blindfolded the next night. Instead, they gave him darkened glasses, bound them around the back of his head, pulling them tight against his eyes, and ripped the sleeves off his shirt. It would be hard to draft, and anyone around him would have ample warning. "Apparently there's something they want us to see," Caris said, as the guards, middlemen and drafters hustled them out of the wagon they'd been sharing. They were brought to a security perimeter out away from the tents. It was oddly separate from the rest of the camp, given far too much room. The perimeter itself was simply a rope strung between posts, pounded quickly into the ground, but it was huge, and no one from the camp even came close to violating the circle. Inside, looking tiny compared to the size of the circle, was a crowd gathered before a platform. The sun had fully set, but it wasn't yet dark.
"They don't want to be overheard," Caris said. "Tells you how crazy they are. They're going to rally the troops with some idiocy any Norm would mock outright."
Norm? Oh, a person who couldn't draft. Wait, that meant... As they were walking closer, Kip saw that his inference was correct. Every single person here was a drafter. There had to be 800 or 1,000 drafters here.
Orholm, Caris breathed. There must be 500 drafters here.
So I can't count.
So what?
But even Kip's bravado melted away as they got closer. His and Caris's tenders pushed them into the crowd, and the first person they pushed out of the way stared at them with wild green eyes. His halos were cracked, snakes of green wriggling through the whites of his eyes. Kip felt like he was passing through a menagerie. It seemed almost everyone light-skinned enough for it to show had skin stained by Luxin. Green, blue, red, yellow, orange, even purple. When he looked into the superviolet drafters stood out like beacons. They'd worked designs into their cloaks, their armor, even their skin, all invisible to anyone but other superviolets. Adjusting his eyes, Kip saw that the sub-reds had done the same, etching dragons, phoenixes, whirls, and flames onto their clothes. Blues wore spikes curling like ram's horns or knife edges along their forearms. They passed an orange. The man looked normal, except he'd slicked back his hair with orange Luxin as if it were hair oil, and the whites of his eyes were solid orange, leaving no differentiation from white to iris. Only the tiny black dots of his pupils marring that perfect color. A green clad only in leaves hissed at them. Then she laughed.
A menagerie indeed, except Kip was in the cage with the animals. They were brought all the way to the front. The crowd was arrayed in front of a stone rising out of the ground, its surfaces worn smooth by wind and rain, but tall enough to be a platform. As Kip and Karis arrived, a man climbed up on the rock wearing a hooded cloak. He reached the top of the stone, threw back his hood, and tore off the cloak, throwing it aside as if it disgusted him. The man's entire body glowed in the gathering dark. He stood, defiant, silent, legs braced. He extended a hand toward the crowd, and at every 5 paces, in a wave, torches burst into flame, bathing them in light. Last, torches ringing his stone platform caught fire, and Kip saw that the man was made entirely of Luxin. And he was glowing from within. All around, drafters were dropping to their knees, before Lord Omnichrome. But not all of them. Those who stood looked awkward, conflicted. For those who bowed weren't just bowing. They were pressing their faces to the ground. This was pure religious devotion.
"Don't bow," Karis said. "That's no god."
"What is he?"
Kip whispered.
"My brother."
Lord Omnichrome extended his hands.
"Please, no. Brothers, sisters, stand. Stand with me. We have fallen prostrate before men for far too long."
The orange drafter, the artist, a hyad, fell prostrate before Gavin. He was to be the first of the night. It was an honored place, and a hyad deserved honor. Real honor, not this travesty. But there was no way out. There never was. Gavin stepped forward. "Stand, my child," he said. Usually when he called the drafters "my child," he felt sardonic, but a hyad was a child, or at least barely a man. A hyad stood. He met Gavin's eyes, then quickly looked away. "You have something to say," Gavin said. "This is the time." Some drafters felt the need to confess sins or secrets. Some made requests. Some just wanted to express a frustration, a fear, a doubt. Depending on the number of drafters to be freed before dawn, each year Gavin took as much time with each drafter as he could.
"I failed you, Lord Prism," a hyad said. "I failed my family. They always said I was the son who could have been great. Instead, I'm a waste. An addict. I'm the gifted one who couldn't handle Lord Hollam's gift."
Bitter tears rolled down his cheeks. He still couldn't look Gavin in the eye. "Look at me," Gavin said. He took the young man's face in his hands. "You joined me in the greatest work I have ever done. You did what I, the Prism, couldn't do. Any man who has seen a sunset knows that Orholm values beauty. You made that wall as beautiful and terrible as Orholm himself. What you did will stand for 1,000 years.
"But we lost!"
"We lost," Gavin acknowledged. "My failure, not yours. Kingdoms come and go, but that wall will protect thousands yet unborn, and it will inspire hundreds of thousands more. I couldn't have done that. Only you could. You, a hyad, have made beauty. Orholm gave you a gift, and you have given a gift to the world. That doesn't sound like failure to me. Your family will be proud. I am proud of you, a hyad. I will never forget you. You have inspired me." A quick grin flickered over the young man's face.
"It is a pretty great piece, huh?"
"Not bad for your first try," Gavin said. A hyad laughed. His whole demeanor changed. He was a light indeed. A gift to the world, beautiful and so burning with life. "Are you ready, son?" Gavin asked.
"Gavin Gyle," the young man said. "My Lord Prism. You, sir, are a great man and a great Prism. Thank you. I am ready."
"A hyad, Brightwater, Orholm gave you a gift," Gavin began. The last name was the invention of the moment. In Paria, the only people given 2 names were great men and women, and sometimes their children. From the sudden tears welling in a hyad's eyes and the deep breath he took, his chest swelling with pride, Gavin knew he'd said the perfect thing. "And you have stewarded well the gift he gave you. It is time to lay your burden down, the hired Brightwater. You gave the full measure. Your service will not be forgotten, but your failures are hereby blotted out, forgotten, erased. Well done, true and faithful servant. You have fulfilled the pact.
They say we take a pact. We make an oath, and with that oath they bind us, they bury us,
Lord Omnichrome said. Liv was pushing carefully through the throng, moving toward the front. She swore she'd seen Kip led there, black spectacles bound to his head, but everyone else was paying rapt attention to the freak up front, so she couldn't move too quickly. Instead, she pretended to listen too, and moved slowly.
Like this,
Lord Omnichrome said. He gestured to the rounded stone on which he stood.
This is all that's left of what was once a great civilization. You've seen these relics scattered throughout this land. Statues of great men, broken by the pygmies who followed.
Liv's ears perked up. Recton had had a broken statue, out in an orange grove. No one had ever said anything about where it came from. She thought that was because no one knew.
You think these statues are a mystery?
Lord Omnichrome asked.
They're no mystery. You think it was a coincidence the Prism's war ended here, in Tyria? You think the Giles simply wandered the seven satrapies until their armies found each other, and it happened to be here? Let me tell you something you already know, something that all of you have believed but no one dared to say. The wrong Gile won the Prism's war. Dazen Gile was trying to change things, and they killed him for it. The Chromeria killed Dazen Gile. They killed him because they were worried he would change everything. They feared him because Dazen Gile wanted to free us.
And there was some consternation in the crowd at that phrase. They all knew what day it was, and that the Prism was in Garriston, not even a league away, performing the freeing this very night.
You see,
Lord Omnichrome said,
you feel that uneasiness? Because the Chromeria has twisted our very language against us. Dazen wanted to free us. Dazen knew that light cannot be chained.
Light cannot be chained, some of the drafters echoed. It was an almost religious refrain.
The freeing, they call it. Lay your burdens down, the Prism says. I give you absolution and freedom, he says. Do you know what he gives us? Do you know?
I give you absolution, Gavin said, his heart in his throat, as a hired knelt at his feet, eyes up, right hand on Gavin's thigh. I give you freedom. Orholm bless you, and take you to his arms. He drew his knife and buried it in a hired's chest, right in the heart. He withdrew the blade. A perfect thrust. But then he'd had a lot of practice. He didn't look at the wound, didn't watch the blood bloom on a hired's shirt. He held the boy's eyes as the life went out of them, and when it did, Gavin said,
please forgive me. Please forgive me.
Gavin had sheathed the dagger and he was scrubbing his hands on the blood rag he carried, though they were clean. He stopped.
They murder you,
Lord Omnichrome shouted.
They stick a knife in you and watch you die. As you beg, they watch, and they say their god smiles on this. Tell me, is this any way to treat our elders? Under the Chromeria, we barely have elders. They've killed them all, oh, except for the White, except for Andros Gile and his wife. The rules don't apply to them, but to you and me, and our mothers, and our fathers. We should be killed. They say this is Orholm's will. They say it is the pact. Like something we swore to as ignorant children, makes their murder of our parents good and right.
What insanity is this?
A woman serves the seven satrapies for all her life, and then as a reward she's murdered? Is this freedom? Is this what they call freeing her?
Liv caught sight of Kip, but she wasn't pushing toward him anymore.
You know it's wrong. I know it's wrong. They know it's wrong. That's why they speak about it in hushed tones and euphemisms. It's not just. It's not a freeing. It's a murder. Let's be clear about that.
And then they don't even have the decency to give your body back to your family. They use it in some dark ritual instead. Is that what our fathers served so long to get? Is that just? The Chromeria soils everything it touches. And do you think that all who are freed have volunteered?
Lord Omnichrome laughed derisively. As the blackguards took Ahayad's body out of the room, careful not to spill any blood, there was a single knock on the door. One strike, followed by nothing. It took Gavin a moment to remember. Bass the Simple had never really understood knocking. "Come in, Bass," Gavin said. "Children and idiots, this is who I kill. I bathe in the blood of innocence." The man came in. He was actually quite handsome, dressed in his finery. Unlike other simpletons Gavin had known, there was no sign of Bass's difference in his facial features.
"I am sorry for coming out of turn, Lord Prism. I have a question, and I did not wish to interrupt my freeing to ask it."
That he was interrupting someone else's freeing to ask the question didn't occur to him, of course. "Please ask," Gavin said.
"I heard Evie Grouse talking about Brightwater Wall. Evie is a green-yellow bichrome. She's from the Blood Forest, but I don't think she's scary at all. My mother used to tell me that anyone with red hair is just as like to set you on fire as look at you, but Evie isn't like that."
Gavin knew Evie well. Not classically bright, she was incredibly intuitive but rarely trusted herself. At least she hadn't years ago.
"Evie once saved me from a charging—"
"What did she say, Bass?" Gavin asked.
"She didn't say anything. She just saved me. I guess she might have yelled. I couldn't tell for sure."
"What did Evie say about Brightwater Wall?"
"I don't like it when you interrupt, Lord Prism. It makes me nervous."
Gavin stifled his impatience. Pushing harder would make Bass completely incapable of speech. Bass saw that Gavin wasn't going to push and then thought for a moment. Gavin could see him find the mental path once more.
"Evie said the Brightwater was drafted perfectly. She said she didn't remember you being a super chromat. I can't see the color differentiations myself, of course, but I don't think she'd lie. And Gavin Gile wasn't a super chromat. His brother Dazen was. And you're taller than Gavin. He wore boots to make himself look taller, but Dazen was taller by his 13th birthday. I remember that day. It was sunny. My grandmother said that Aura Holland had always smiled on the Giles. I was wearing my blue coat."
Gavin wasn't listening. He felt like the floor had dropped out from under his feet. He'd known this moment was coming. He'd expected it for 16 years. He'd gone into his first meetings as Gavin, expecting anyone, everyone, to point and scream, "Imposter! Counterfeit!" Others had figured it out, but never in a way he couldn't contain. He couldn't discredit Bass. The man was immune to political currents, and everyone knew it, and if asked, Bass would point out 100 differences between Gavin and Dazen. By the time he'd done speaking, the Gavin mask would be destroyed. And yet he'd come alone. On this night, of all nights.
"So my question was, why are you lying, Dazen? Why are you pretending to be Gavin? Dazen is bad. He kills people. He killed the White Oaks, all of them. They say he went from room to room in their mansion, even killing the servants, and then he burned it all down to hide his crimes. The children were trapped in the basement. They found their little bodies in a pile. They were hugging each other. I went there. I saw them."
Bass stopped speaking, evidently consumed by that old image. With his perfect memory, it must have been vivid indeed.
"I told those little charred bodies that I would kill Dazen Gile," Bass said.
Gavin felt an old dread, like the sting of an old master's lash. Bass was a green-blue superviolet polychrome. Every drafter was changed over time by his colours. Only the wildness of green would make the formerly order-obsessed Bass skip his place in line. But the orderliness of blue was making him crazy to know why, to see how things fit together. "Bass, I'm going to tell you something I've only told one other person in the world. I'm going to answer your question. You deserve it." He lowered his voice. "When I was 16 years old, I had a vision, a waking dream. I was in front of a presence. I fell on my face. I knew he was holy, and I was afraid.
Or Holum himself? Bass asked.
He looked doubtful.
My mother told me that people who say they speak for Orholm are usually lying, and Dazen is a liar?
His voice pitched up at the end. The last thing Gavin needed was Bass shouting something about Dazen. Do you want to hear my answer or not? He asked sharply. Bass hesitated.
Yes, but don't you—
Gavin stabbed him in the heart. Bass's eyes went wide. He grabbed Gavin's arms. Gavin withdrew the dagger. Coldly. So coldly, Gavin said, "You gave the full measure, Bass. Your service will not be forgotten. Your failures are forgotten, erased. I give you absolution. I give you freedom." By the time he said absolution, Bass was dead. Gavin lowered the man to the floor carefully. He went and knocked at the side door. The blackguards came in and took the body, and just like that, Gavin got away with murder.
Chapter 79. The man was a liar.
Kip didn't know exactly what was lie and what was truth, but Lord Omnicrome was King Haradul's right hand. They'd massacred his village. For nothing. If murder was nothing to them, what was a lie? But there was truth here, like all the best lies. That really was what the pact meant. No wonder they talked about it in sidelong conversations, hushed tones. You got old, you broke your halo, you became like a mad dog. They had to put you down. Kip remembered when Corvin's dog had been bitten by a raccoon, and later started foaming at the mouth. Corvin, the Alcaldesser, and some of the other men loaded muskets and went after it. Corvin himself blew its brains out. He hid his face afterward, and everyone pretended not to see his tears. It had been a year before he talked about that dog. But when he did, it was never of its madness, never of killing his dog. This was the same. No one talked about the freeing because no one wanted to dishonor the dead. Kip was a great man right until he went crazy and started trying to kill his friends. Right until we had to put him down. So it was a hard truth. That didn't make it a lie. Indeed, it probably made it more likely that it was true. But no one in this crowd wanted to accept that. They wanted someone to blame for the death of their parents. They didn't want to die themselves. They could dress that up in some holy-sounding bullshit, but Kip had seen behind the veil. These people were murderers. Gavin was a good man. A great man, a giant, among dwarfs, so he had to do hard things. Great men made the hard choices, so everyone could survive. So he held people to the pact, so what? Everyone swore to it. Everyone knew what they were swearing. There was no mystery, no con. They made a deal, and they liked the deal until they had to pay the price. These people were cowards, oath-breakers, scum. I've got to get out of here. He turned and saw the last woman he expected to see here.
Elysian water clocks claim this is the shortest night of the year, Felia Gale said from the doorway. But it's always been the longest for you.
Gavin looked up at her, grey-faced. I didn't expect you until dawn. She smiled.
There was some disturbance with the order. Bass the Simple cut in earlier than he was supposed to. Some withdrew until later.
She shrugged. Withdrew? So maybe they know. It's all falling apart. Maybe it's best this way. I killed my own mother now, and she doesn't have to see it all come crashing down.
Son.
She said.
Dazen.
The word was almost a sigh, a release of pent-up pressure, truth spoken aloud after years of lies. Mother. It was good to see her happy, but terrible to see her here. I can't. I didn't even take you on that flight I promised you.
You really can fly?
He nodded, his throat tight.
My son can fly.
Her smile lit her face.
Dazen, I'm so proud of you.
Gavin tried to speak, but failed. Her eyes were gentle.
I'll help you, she said.
She knelt at the rail, opting for more formality. With his mother, Gavin should have known.
Lord Prism, I have sins to confess. Will you shrive me?
Gavin blinked back, sudden tears, mastered himself.
Gladly, daughter.
Her attitude of simple piety helped him play his part. He was not her son, not here and now. He was her spiritual father, a link to Orholam on the holiest day of her life.
Lord Prism, I married unwisely and lived fearfully. I let myself be owned by my fear that my husband would put me aside, and didn't speak when I knew I should. I let my sons be pitted against each other, and one is dead because of it. Their father didn't foresee it because he was a fool. But I knew.
Mother, Gavin interjected.
Daughter,
she corrected firmly. Gavin paused, acquiesced. Daughter, go on.
I have spoken cruel words. I have lied 1,000 times. I have treated my slaves without regard to their welfare.
She spoke for 5 minutes, not sparing herself. Blunt and forthright, not condensing her answers for her sake but for Gavin's. He had others to shrive this night. It was surreal. Gavin had heard stunning admissions and seen darker sides of people with saintly reputations for the last 16 years, but hearing her confess beating an innocent slave in her rage minutes after finding Andros in bed with another woman was heart-rending, dislocating. To hear his mother confess was like seeing her naked.
And I have killed